Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the May 29th, 2026 issue of the Week. Before we get going, just a note for the listeners. I'm actually going to be out of town for the next 2 weeks after this. So we are going to get two shows out of the May 29th, 2026 issue. And then the second show will repeat for a week. And then I will be very much looking forward to being back with a new issue in that middle of June. And so, the formats may be a little different than the normal, but we'll get a lot more out of this magazine. The cover drawing for today shows our dear president, Mr. Trump, sitting at a desk, and there is a long line of people. Looks like they are from the January 6th riot. The one in the head of the line is a familiar figure, the guy with the buffalo headdress with the horns and a face painted like the American flag and no shirt. Mr. Trump has a stack of bundles of $100 bills on the desk and looks like they're all standing in line. He's handing them out. The headline is Cash for Criminals, Trump's $1.8 billion plan to reward January 6 rioters. That is our first main story, and we will start right there. Outrage erupts over Trump's slush fund for allies. What happened? In a move that stunned government ethics experts, the Trump administration this week rolled out a $1.8 billion fund to compensate supposed victims of Biden-era lawfare and barred the IRS from pursuing any and all pending tax claims against the president, his family, or his businesses. This is one of the single most corrupt acts in American history, said Donald Sherman of the Nonpartisan Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. The Anti-Weaponization Fund set at $1.776 billion in a nod to America's founding, was created by the Justice Department to settle a $10 billion suit President Trump brought against the IRS for failing to stop the leak of his tax returns during his first term. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche said the fund will compensate people targeted under Biden for political, personal, or ideological reasons, and that Trump and his family will not receive payouts. Blanche refused to rule out payment to rioters convicted of assaulting police in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Trump said he wasn't involved in creating the fund, but that it would aid people who were imprisoned wrongly and who turned out to be right. Democrats assailed what they called a slush fund for Trump's allies. It's nothing short of the sitting president of the United States looting from the Treasury for his own gain, said Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington. Two police officers who clashed with rioters on January 6 sued to block the fund, saying it would help finance the insurrectionist and paramilitary groups that commit violence in Trump's name. Senator John Thune, the top Senate Republican, said he was not a big fan of the fund and expected it to receive a full vetting from lawmakers. What the columnist said: this is Trump's most brazen theft of taxpayer cash yet, said Andrew Egger in the Bulwark. Everything about this obscene setup is designed to short-circuit all outside accountability. Blanche's order says the U.S. has no liability for misuse of the funds, and the five-person panel Blanche will pick to run the fund will not only get to keep secret how they're making disbursement decisions, they can also keep a lid on who's getting paid. This is emperor stuff and grounds for impeachment under any Congress with a shred of dignity. Trump's IRS lawsuit was bad, said National Review in an editorial. But this boondoggle is even worse. It amounts to a new government program not authorized by Congress, created under the fictional pretense of settling a dubious lawsuit the presiding judge seemed poised to throw out. The disbursement of the money through the U.S. Judgment Fund, a pot of money used to settle lawsuits against the U.S., may be legal, but there's nothing in the Constitution that requires Congress to passively let this sort of thing happen. The most egregious part is the dropping of all tax audits of Trump and his family, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. It shields them from any scrutiny of their business deals and financial arrangements, and comes just after financial disclosures revealed that Trump bought and sold stocks worth at least $220 million, including in companies he's promoted, in the first quarter of the year. The financial stakes for Trump are significant. In 2024, the Times reported that Trump could face a more than $100 million tax liability. This grift couldn't be more blatant if Trump walked out of Fort Knox with a shopping cart filled with gold bullion, said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast. And it's just the cherry atop a vast campaign of corruption. He's accepted a luxury jet from Qatar, solicited donations to projects designed to glorify him, doled out pardons to deep-pocketed donors, sold Trump watches and other swag, and engaged in shady crypto ventures that have tripled his wealth to an estimated $6.5 billion. We are no longer a shining city on the hill. We are instead a stinking cesspool of corruption, a republic for the rapacious. Look beyond the pure corruption, and you'll see an even uglier message in this fund, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. Trump has all but declared that he's going to use this $1.8 billion to reward the insurrectionists who were punished for trying to violently overturn his 2020 election loss. He could have handed out that cash toward the end of his term, but he's doing it now, as the midterms approach and his popularity plummets, to communicate directly that loyal allies can expect lavish rewards. As Republicans sit quietly or tut-tut from the sidelines, his intentions grow only more naked. And we've got two other shorter main stories we'll pick up. Trump sweeps out more Republican foes. What happened? President Trump's retribution tour rolled on with two more rivals losing to Trump-endorsed challengers in primaries this week, further cementing his hold over the Republican Party. Kentucky Representative Thomas Massey, an outspoken libertarian critic of Trump's war in Iran and his handling of the Epstein files, lost by nearly 10 percentage points to former Navy SEAL Ed Gowring. It was the most expensive House primary in history, drawing more than $32 million in ad spending. The president intensified his attacks on Massey in recent weeks, calling him a moron at the National Prayer Breakfast and urging supporters to vote for his handpicked challenger. In Louisiana, voters swept out Senator Bill Cassidy, who tried but failed to overcome his decision to vote to convict Trump in his 2021 impeachment trial. That disloyalty, Trump wrote on social media, is now part of legend. Senator John Cornyn, the Republican from Texas, may be next on the chopping block after an emboldened Trump endorsed his primary challenger, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Trump called Cornyn a good man, but said he wasn't supportive of me when times were tough. Brad Raffensperger, who defied Trump's attempt to overturn Georgia's 2020 election results, also got trounced in his gubernatorial primary, finishing behind two pro-Trump candidates. In Pennsylvania, retired firefighter and union leader Bob Brooks, endorsed by both the Keystone State's moderate Governor Josh Shapiro and progressives like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, won a crowded Democratic congressional primary in a closely watched swing district. What the columnist said: Massey's defeat may be the end of GOP dissent, said Mary Ellen Klass in Bloomberg, at least among elected officials who still need to face voters. Massey voted with Trump 90% of the time, but he dared to challenge the president over his abandoned campaign promises, and he got crushed by Trump-faithful older voters. GOP lawmakers don't answer to their constituents or even their own values anymore. The man in the Oval Office alone commands absolute loyalty. Yet Trump has created a conundrum, said Shane Goldmacher in the New York Times. He seems more keen to leverage his popularity with the MAGA base to settle scores than to repair his image among the independents his party will need in November's midterms. His approval ratings continue to crater, including in one New York Times Siena survey that shows only 20% of independents support the job he's doing. The Paxton endorsement made Chuck Schumer's day, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The well-respected Cornyn has been a reliable vote for Trump for years and has shown four terms over that he can beat Democrats in November. The scandal-ridden Paxton, on the other hand, has been impeached by his own party, been accused of bribery, and confessed to infidelity. It's no surprise that polls show he's locked in a dead heat with Democratic nominee James Tallarico, who could help flip the Senate. If that happens, Trump will deserve complete and total credit, as he likes to put it. Congress demands answers on Iran. What happened? In a sign of growing frustration with a conflict that has sent gas and food prices soaring, the Senate this week advanced a measure to force President Trump to either get congressional authorization for the Iran war or end it. Four Senate Republicans broke with their party to pass the resolution, with Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, defeated by a Trump-backed primary opponent last week, joining Senators Rand Paul, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins. In the House, an Armed Services Committee hearing with U.S. Central Command leader Admiral Brad Cooper turned bitterly contentious. Representative Seth Moulton, Democrat from Massachusetts, asked whether there were plans to actually win this war, wondering how many more Americans we have to ask to die for this mistake. Cooper called this line of questioning entirely inappropriate. Trump said he'd been an hour away from renewing strikes on Iran this week before Gulf Arab leaders convinced him to delay, and he said a full, large-scale assault will still happen if Iran does not soften its demands. Iran's military said if the U.S. resumes attacks, it would open new fronts that would further drive up global energy costs. The blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, through which much of the world's oil usually passes, has already pushed gas prices up 60% to over $4.55 a gallon nationwide and over $6 a gallon in California. Nearly two-thirds of Americans and even a majority of Republicans under 45 now say that attacking Iran was the wrong decision. But whether it's popular or not popular, Trump insisted, I have to do it. What the columnist said. Trump's overconfidence in his gut has failed him, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. He has relied on an ever-shifting perception of his political needs rather than military advice to start and stop the conflict. But the blunt reality remains. Wiping out Iran's nuclear capabilities would require a full-scale invasion. Even just freeing up the Strait of Hormuz would require cruisers, minesweepers, dozens of aircraft, and as many as 10,000 troops along the shores of the strait. Trump must either commit the troops or change his objectives. Let's go with choice C. Forge a deal to open the strait, said Max Voot in the Washington Post. If fighting resumes, Iran will blow up oil and gas facilities and vital water desalination plants in Gulf Arab states like Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. The resulting humanitarian and economic catastrophe would make the current oil disruptions seemed like child's play. Yet the options for a deal range from bad to terrible, said Daniel R. DePetris in the Los Angeles Times. Because Trump tore up the pact President Obama struck to rein in Iran's nuclear program, Tehran now has stockpiles of enriched uranium. Because he attacked, it now has effective control of the Strait of Hormuz. Any agreement to end the war will have to include some of Iran's terms, including retaining some uranium and some kind of Iranian role in the management of the strait. It will be a bad outcome, and Trump has nobody to blame but himself. We will ultimately get to something other than Mr. Trump, but in the meantime, the controversy of the week is Trump in China. American decline on display. He came, he saw, he left without much to show for it, said David Smith in The Guardian. Throughout last week's state visit to Beijing, President Trump slathered compliments on Xi Jinping, praising China's president for life as a great leader who is very tall. But Trump's flattery got him nowhere. After 43 hours, he flew home having secured only the vague outlines of a few commercial deals. No agreement to slow the AI arms race, and no help on Iran, which China could pressure to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. In fairness, Trump did extract a promise from Xi to send him seeds from some rosebuds bushes he admired. Trump reciprocated with a far more valuable gift, said The Economist, doubt over U.S. support for Taiwan. Despite a Reagan-era commitment to never negotiate with China over arms sales to the island nation, which Beijing considers a rogue province, Trump said he was delaying approval of a $14 billion weapons sale to Taiwan, calling it a good negotiating chip in talks with Beijing. As for America's long-standing posture of strategic ambiguity on whether U.S. forces would defend Taiwan from a Chinese attack, Trump told reporters on the flight home, "The last thing we need right now is a war that's 9,500 miles away." "Not so fast," said Gerald Baker in the Wall Street Journal. "Trump says a lot of things, particularly in the afterglow of a state visit. But Secretary of State Marco Rubio quickly clarified that our Taiwan policy is unchanged, and U.S. law requires Washington to give Taiwan the means to defend itself. But the change in China's posture was unmistakable. And emboldened Xi warned of looming clashes and even conflicts over Taiwan, and cautioned Trump to avoid the Thucydides trap, whereby a declining power's fear of a rising one draws both into war. Once the classical reference was explained to our president, Trump insisted Xi had been sliding America's decline under sleepy Joe Biden. But Xi's meaning was plain, as is China's new confidence. "It's easy to overlearn the lesson of history," said Lydia Polgreen in the New York Times. In his chronicle of the Peloponnesian War from 431 to 404 BC, the ancient Greek historian Thucydides charts the violence that erupted when Athens, an ambitious power much like Xi's China, challenged the preeminence of Sparta. That scenario has repeated throughout history, with the ambition and aggression of the challenger almost always ending in bloodshed. But the current threat to the U.S.-led global order is not China so much as the chaos Trump has unleashed with his bullying of allies, his self-sabotaging tariffs, and his epic miscalculation in Iran. America is overthrowing America. Xi should check his hubris, said Ross Douthat, also in the Times. For the record, Sparta defeated upstart Athens in the Peloponnesian War, and the post-COVID U.S. economy has actually outpaced China's in recent years. Longer term, China's crashing birth rate, now one child per woman and falling, will make it incredibly difficult to sustain economic growth. As for the Thucydides trap, China shouldn't worry, said Paul Krugman in his Substack newsletter. America is declining, but we're not about to lash out at a rising China while we're led by a self-absorbed, pathetic president whose main message to Americans upon returning home was that Xi has nice ballrooms, and therefore he deserves one too. If you want classical analogies, think of America right now as the Roman Empire under Caligula, although Caligula didn't do anything like as much damage. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for diplomacy after the Chinese government, which in 2020 banned then-Senator Marco Rubio from entering China, changed the official transliteration of Rubio to let the Secretary of State accompany President Trump on last week's state visit. The new spelling of Rubio replaces the RU character with one meaning rash, rude, and clumsy. It was a good week for he who was foretold, a.k.a. Henrik Refsnes Mortvedt, 6, of Norway, who spotted a piece of rusty metal poking out of a plowed field while on a school trip. Archaeologists excavated the item, which they identified as a 1,300-year-old single-edged sword from before the Viking Age. It was a good week for artificial intelligence after a Michigan man won a $1 million Powerball prize using numbers he was given by an animatronic Zoltar fortune-teller machine during a Las Vegas trip 30 years ago. I don't think this is going to fully hit me until I cash the check, said Stephen Hookson, 56. But it was a bad week for natural intelligence after the CEO of multinational bank Standard Chartered announced plans to fire over 15% of its 52,000 support staff by 2030 as we go forward into AI. Chief Executive Bill Winters insisted the move was not strictly a cost-cutting measure, but a necessary reduction in lower-value human capital. It was a bad week for Arnold Palmer after the collapse of Spirit Airlines left the Pittsburgh area airport named for the local-born golfing legend with zero commercial flights. Everybody loves this airport, said its director Mo Haas. We had people come from Canada and Ohio just to jump on a flight. Finally, it was a bad week for timekeeping after Russian President Vladimir Putin reportedly barred officials from wearing wristwatches in one-on-one Kremlin meetings, apparently fearing a James Bond-style assassination attempt. The ban, said a source, applies to both electronic and mechanical watches. And a short and other news piece. EPA plans to scrap limits on forever chemicals in water. The Environmental Protection Agency this week proposed ending the nation's first federal limits on certain harmful forever chemicals in drinking water. The Biden administration had ordered that 6 PFAS compounds, nicknamed forever chemicals because they can take centuries to break down, can be almost completely eradicated from drinking water by 2029, citing links to cancer, infertility, and other serious health problems. EPA leader Lee Zeldin said the Biden administration had rushed those regulations, leaving them vulnerable to court challenges. The agency's proposal would scrap the limits on 4 of the PFAS compounds and give water utilities 2 more years to comply with rules on the 2 remaining compounds. This is a betrayal of public health and the mission of making America healthier, said David Andrews, chief science officer for the nonprofit Environmental Working Group. And we will pick up some of the short news pieces in the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance this week. Starting with the U.S. at a glance, in Minneapolis, ICE charges. State prosecutors this week charged an ICE officer with assault for shooting a Venezuelan man during the immigration crackdown in Minneapolis in January. Federal officials initially said Immigration and Customs Enforcement Officer Christian J. Castro was acting in self-defense when he shot at Julio Sasso Solis through the front door of his house, striking him in the leg. Castro claimed that Sasso Solis and another man had attacked agents with a broom and a snow shovel. Former Homeland Security boss Christy Noem said it was attempted murder. But charges against the two men were dropped after video evidence contradicted Castro's claims. Castro has now been charged with four counts of assault and one count of falsely reporting a crime. His federal badge does not make him immune from state charges for his criminal conduct, said Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty. San Diego, mosque murders. Two teenagers shot and killed three people this week at San Diego's largest mosque in a suspected hate crime before taking their own lives, police said. The attack began on the morning of May 18th when Kane Clark, 17, and Caleb Vasquez, 18, armed with rifles and handguns, ran past security guard Amin Abdullah at the entrance of the Islamic Center of San Diego. Abdullah, a father of eight, quickly reached for his radio, ordered a lockdown, and shot at both gunmen, who returned fire and killed him. The radio call likely helped keep the attackers away from a school inside the mosque, where 140 children were in attendance. Two other community members were killed in the parking lot after they engaged the suspects to save more people. Law enforcement found 30 firearms, crossbow, and tactical gear at the teens' homes, as well as a manifesto containing Nazi and white supremacist symbols and broad hatred toward multiple races and religions. The suspects allegedly met and became radicalized online. Omaha, hantavirus quarantine. U.S. health officials have issued quarantine orders to two American passengers who were exposed to the hantavirus on the MV Hondius cruise ship in April, a rare legal step that can be taken if someone objects to a public health request. Though the ship's 18 American passengers are already being monitored in isolation at a special quarantine facility, two individuals were hoping to go home early. In an interview with the New York Times, Angela Perryman, 47, said she'd had a brief conversation with a fellow passenger who later died from the virus. She is not experiencing symptoms herself. Ferryman tested negative for the virus and made plans to depart the Nebraska facility this week. Citing hantavirus's 42-day incubation period, acting CDC Director Jay Bhattacharya said no. 11 hantavirus cases have been linked to the cruise, including three deaths. The Americans were asked to stay in quarantine until May 31st. Richmond, Virginia. Redistricting. Democrats suffered two major setbacks in the nationwide redistricting war in under 7 days. The Supreme Court upheld a Virginia court decision last week, striking down a new congressional map that was approved in April by voters and would have boosted Democrats' chances in 10 of the state's 11 districts. The state high court voided the map, saying Democrats had failed to follow the procedural requirements to place a constitutional amendment on the ballot. Democrats filed an emergency appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court, but the conservative-dominated court rejected them in a one-sentence order that did not give a vote count or provide reasoning. Democratic Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger accused both courts of choosing to nullify an election and the votes of more than 3 million Virginians. Meanwhile, South Carolina's state house this week advanced a new congressional map at the urging of President Trump that benefits Republicans and is designed to erase the state's only Democratic seat, held by Representative James Clyburn. And the world at a glance. This is in Nuuk, Greenland, that's spelled N-U-U-K. Resenting the U.S. Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry, President Trump's envoy to Greenland, traveled to Nuuk this week to listen and learn, but was met by hecklers shouting, "Go home." Greenland's leaders worry that ongoing talks, originally seen as an off-ramp for Trump's push to seize the Arctic island, could end up limiting their sovereignty. Trump is demanding new bases to allow U.S. military forces to stay indefinitely, as well as veto power over Chinese and Russian investments. Denmark, which controls Greenland's foreign affairs, insists the territory's 57,000 people must decide their future. "Independence will be impossible if Trump gets his way," said Greenland lawmaker Justice Hansen. "We might as well raise our own flag half-mast." It's from London. Dueling protests. London police arrested dozens of people last week at opposing marches by far-right Unite the Kingdom protesters and pro-Palestinian activists. The Met deployed 4,000 officers to keep the group separate. The right-wing rally, led by Islamophobic nationalist Tommy Robinson, drew about 60,000 people, far below the million he promised. About 20 of those participants were arrested for racist and homophobic hate speech. Robinson spoke of his newfound Christian faith, embraced during a prison stint last year, but that alienated many of his followers. "It was like he was trying to appeal to a U.S. audience," said observer Nick Lowles of the anti-racism group Hope Not Hate. About a dozen people were arrested at the pro-Palestinian march, several for anti-Jewish hate speech, and one for holding a sign reading, "Globalize the Intifada." Lagos, Nigeria. ISIS leader killed. U.S. and Nigerian forces killed Abu Bilal al-Minuki, the second in command of ISIS, in a joint operation last week on Lake Chad, at the intersection of four African countries. "He will no longer terrorize the people of Africa or help plan operations to target Americans," President Trump said. U.S. officials said al-Minuki was killed on an island in the lake in a three-hour helicopter-borne assault involving two dozen commandos, including members of SEAL Team 6. No Nigerian or American casualties were reported. Military analysts are now going through information on ISIS's recruiting and operations in Africa that was found on laptops and cell phones seized in the raid. Nigerian President Bola Ahmed Tinubu's office said al-Minuki, erroneously reported to have been killed in 2024, was spotted near the lake, and both governments agreed it was the right time to strike. Goma, Congo. Ebola emergency. The World Health Organization last week declared an Ebola outbreak in Congo and Uganda to be a global health emergency. Health officials reported over 140 deaths and more than 500 people infected with hemorrhagic fever, including a U.S. doctor and several other American aid workers. The crisis started in Congo's Ituri province, where armed conflict allowed it to spread undetected. There is no vaccine or treatment for this strain. Bungingbugyo, which can kill up to 50% of those infected. During previous Ebola outbreaks, the U.S. took the lead in coordinating the international response. But President Trump's foreign aid cuts, including the pullout from the WHO, have left health teams severely depleted. There is a lot of nervousness among Ebola watchers, former U.S. aid official Jeremy Kondik said. It's from Mogadishu, Somalia. Iran war causes hunger. The Iran war is pushing tens of millions of people into acute hunger, the World Food Program warned this week. The energy crisis driven by the blocking of oil shipments through the Strait of Hormuz has sent fuel, food, and fertilizer costs skyrocketing across the world, hitting the poorest the hardest. In Somalia, which imports 70% of its food and has been ravaged by drought, staples like rice and flour have doubled in price since the war started in February. And 500,000 children could starve to death within weeks. The country had already lost its main source of assistance last year when President Trump demolished U.S. aid. Abdullahi Abdi Abdurrahim, 47, said his seven children are surviving only on sorghum porridge and wild grasses. Milk and meat are a dream for us, he said. And finally, from Kyiv, apartment building leveled. Russian missile strikes demolished a nine-story apartment building in Kyiv last week, killing at least 24 people in one of the deadliest attacks on civilians of the four-year war. The massive aerial barrage of some 1,500 drones hit 180 sites across Ukraine, including dozens of residential buildings. Despite that show of force, many analysts say Ukraine now has the upper hand in the conflict. Russia has been losing 35,000 troops a month, and Ukraine is striking deep inside Russia, hitting oil and defense sites as far away as Moscow. The problem is there's a stubborn guy leading Russia who still seems to believe that Ukraine will fall, said Alexander Gubov of the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center. The war is likely to continue because of that. Skipping over to the best columns, and we'll start with Education's Reckless AI Experiment. America's students are the test subjects in a high-risk experiment, said Andy Samarick. In recent years, schools have embraced technology, bringing iPads and smartphones into the classroom, even as reading scores have dropped in 83% of school districts. But the impact of screens is likely to pale in comparison to the damage inflicted by the embrace of artificial intelligence. Many K-12 schools and colleges believe they need to equip students to use this innovative and revolutionary technology. So they're allowing students to use AI to generate plot summaries of books rather than reading them, and to generate ideas for essays and edit and rework what they write. Yes, it's faster, but that's precisely why we should not allow AI in the classroom. Education comes from slow, arduous work that teaches critical thinking, arguably the most crucial aspect of a school's academic mission. Research has shown that heavy use of AI creates mental dependency and jeopardizes students' capacity to read, write, calculate, study, and create. In coming years, when young adults struggle to think through problems and express themselves clearly, we will wonder how in the world we allowed AI to do their thinking for them. Ignoring the will of the voters. If any single law passed by Congress represents the general will of the American people, said Jamelle Bouie, it's the Voting Rights Act. Yet in gutting the pivotal 1965 legislation and its recent Louisiana versus Calais decision, the conservative wing of the Supreme Court treated the law as if it were a handcuff that liberal bureaucrats or judges imposed on the states of the former Confederacy. In reality, the law was a product of an explosion of democratic energy sparked by grassroots civil rights activists. President Lyndon B. Johnson, carried by the momentum of one of the largest landslides in American electoral history, signed the VRA into law. In subsequent decades, Congress after Congress after Congress after Congress reauthorized it. The VRA, in fact, has more democratic legitimacy than the Supreme Court, whose conservative justices were mostly appointed by presidents who failed to win the popular vote. These same arrogant and reactionary justices just invited Republican states to nullify the power of minority voters, which the states are happily rushing to do. The ruling is another flashing warning that the Roberts Court will create any rationale to shape the political system to its liking. This column comes from Cuba. Barely holding on as Trump turns out the lights. The enemy hasn't yet attacked, but Havana looks like a bombed-out city, said Juan Garcia Aguilera in 14E Media from Cuba. Its buildings are split open like broken ribs, crumbling from decades of neglect. Strangled by the U.S. blockade, communist Cuba is out of fuel, and power goes out for days at a time. With no gas for garbage pickup, citizens are burning trash in the streets. People wade through the toxic clouds, sidestepping sewage and hopping over potholes. Plastic, rotten food, and patients are all ablaze. Most Cubans fully recognize Castroism's responsibility for the nation's ruin. President Miguel Díaz-Canel has failed to respond to the energy crisis with structural reforms. Instead, he has resorted to more repression. Yet President Trump's sanctions and threats of invasion have been a gift to the regime. The U.S. aggression has given Díaz-Canel, the embattled successor of Fidel and Raúl Castro, something else to blame besides his incompetence. He can now disguise his mediocrity as martyrdom. In fact, the blockade is the main source of our troubles, said Alejandra Cuadras Marrero in Juventud Rebedel from Cuba. Cuba poses no threat to the U.S., but Trump still wants to bring it to its knees. That's no way to treat a country that has sent doctors, teachers, and professionals to the neediest places on the planet. Cuba's leaders are running out of options, said Cyber Cuba from Spain in an unsigned article. With imports unable to reach the island, Cubans can eat only what they grow there, which isn't much. Rice production had already plummeted even before the fuel crisis. Now, with no fuel for crop dusters or tractors or irrigation, farmers have reverted to using oxen, buffalo, horses, windmills, and solar pumps. Markets are empty, prices are soaring, and nearly all Cubans have begun skipping meals. The government has even asked the World Food Program for help for the first time in history. The U.S. hopes that by inflicting so much suffering on the population, it will provoke a massive uprising that will cause Cuba's communist system to implode, said Fabio E. Fernandez Batista in El Salto from Spain. And maybe it will. The deprivation has already caused political polarization. Some Cubans are cheering the government's call to pull together and step up agricultural production by any means possible. Others are waiting for St. Donald to come to the rescue, even if it means bombs falling on their homeland. But the U.S. could well discover that sending troops into heavily militarized Cuba wouldn't be a walk in the park. Still, the Castroist regime has never seemed weaker, said David Marcial Perez and Carla Gloria Colom in El País from Spain. Last week, CIA Director John Ratcliffe actually came in person to Havana for talks. That leader of the agency that once tried to kill Castro should set foot there was unthinkable, almost heretical for most of Cuban history. But now Cubans will try anything. Pushed to their breaking point, they're staging pop-banging protests and throwing rocks at shuttered gas stations. Unfortunately, no matter how bad it gets, the Castro regime's repressive apparatus is one of the few things that remains standing. Here's one of the technology articles. AI music, the fake artist filling up playlist. The AI slopification of music is here, said Eric Yildirim. It's gotten so difficult to decipher which songs are human-made and which are synthetically produced by artificial intelligence that Spotify, the world's largest audio streaming service, announced recently it's going to append a verification badge on trusted artist pages. It stopped short, however, of an AI ban. That would have hurt outfits like The Velvet Sundown, an indie band that garnered millions of streams on Spotify last summer. Fans later learned that the group was completely AI-generated, including a phony album cover featuring the smiling faces of four fake members. Another music streaming platform, Deezer, reported recently that 44% of its daily uploads were AI-generated songs, and an overwhelming majority of people couldn't tell AI-generated music apart from songs written and performed by actual humans. Humans have been making music for 35,000 years, but AI could be about to end our turn. Billboard allowing fake artists on its charts isn't helping, said Peter A. Berry. For 113 years, the music and entertainment brand has served as an institutional gatekeeper, and its rankings were always a competition between human beings and the limits they naturally possess. But in November, Billboard opened its hallowed charts to non-humans for the first time, allowing streams of songs by AI performers like country music act Breaking Rust and R&B singer Xania Monet to count alongside Taylor Swift and Beyoncé. If Billboard wants to create a separate chart for AI creations, fine, but humans shouldn't be competing against machines that can generate abilities that aren't naturally there. The flood of AI music shows no sign of abating, said Terrence O'Brien in The Verge, and it won't as long as platforms keep allowing it. In survey after survey, public opinion toward AI music is pretty unfavorable, with people most worried about synthetic artists degrading the music. But companies are hesitant to penalize AI use in part because they expect it to become a standard tool in the industry as more artists start to incorporate it into their creative processes in some form. Eventually, it will be impossible to separate music-based AI use, said Nathan Brackett, because behind closed doors, AI tools are creeping into the workflows of top producers, songwriters, and artists. Mikey Shulman, CEO of AI music creation platform Suno, compares it to Ozempic. Everybody is on it, and nobody wants to talk about it. Most musicians aren't using AI to generate entire songs from scratch, but producers will, for example, make funk and soul samples out of AI rather than license original music or hire musicians. And that means for every task that AI streamlines, there might be someone who used to fill that role who isn't paid anymore. On the Talking Points page, religion, Christian nationalism on the mall. The nation just got a preview of what American theocracy would look like, said Guthrie Graves Fitzsimmons in MS.Now. Thousands of people gathered on the National Mall this week for Rededicate 250, a White House-backed and taxpayer-funded prayer event that featured a who's who of religious right figures, including Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, House Speaker Mike Johnson, and evangelical preacher Franklin Graham, who blasted America as sick with sin, transgenderism, same-sex marriage. The kickoff for a series of events celebrating America's 250th anniversary, the rally framed the U.S.'s founding as an explicitly Christian project. It's the most aggressive attack on the Constitution's guarantee of religious freedom that the Christian nationalist movement has yet attempted on American soil. And it's one based on a lie. The U.S. was founded 250 years ago as a secular democracy, not a theocracy. We cannot rededicate something to God when the nation was never dedicated to one narrow religious movement. President Trump, who was busy playing golf, appeared in a pre-recorded video reading from the biblical book of Chronicles, said Sarah Posner in Talking Points memo. Still, his supporters spent the day trying to turn the anniversary of our independence from a king into a spectacle of worship of their wannabe king. Evangelical podcaster Eric Metaxas even claimed in his speech that God had raised up Trump to build a White House ballroom. But Rededicate 250 made it clear that not all Christians are welcome under Trump's tent, said Amanda Marcotte and Salon. Sure, there was a smattering of token Catholics among the speakers, and even one rabbi, but the event was dominated by white, far-right evangelicals. Promoting voices like these sends a message loud and clear. The rest of you don't matter. Such brazen displays of Christian nationalism could push us into a vicious cycle, said Andrew Egger in The Bulwark. The charlatans who spoke at Rededicate 250 are increasingly the only Christians encountered by irreligious types on the left. And the more the religious right ties Christianity to MAGA, the less they can be surprised that their political opponents turn out to be hostile not only to MAGA, but to Christianity itself. For those believers who years ago made peace with Trump on the spurious argument that only he stood between them and a political movement hostile to their faith, I worry that they may meet their destiny on the road they took to avoid it. Abortion, the battle over mifepristone. Abortion access is safe for now, said Lisa Jarvis in Bloomberg. For three long days earlier this month, mail order access to the abortion drug mifepristone was blocked by the conservative-dominated 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals following a request by Louisiana. The state argued that Biden-era FDA rules allowing the drug to be prescribed by telemedicine violated its sovereignty because Louisianans could be shipped the medication despite a state abortion ban. The Fifth Circuit's nationwide ruling meant that women in all states, not just the 20 with abortion restrictions, were suddenly barred from getting mifepristone in the mail. The makers of mifepristone, part of a two-pill regimen used in about 60% of terminations, immediately kicked the case up to the Supreme Court, which last week voted 7-2 to keep the existing FDA rules in place while Louisiana's lawsuit continues in lower court. For women across the U.S., that decision was an immense relief, but it was also a reminder that since the High Court dismantled Roe v. Wade with its 2022 Dobbs ruling, life-saving care for women is always one decision away from disappearing. Pro-life activists are rightly furious to see the Supreme Court's conservative majority go wobbly on the abortion pill, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. Only Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas dissented, with the latter accusing the court of ignoring a criminal enterprise since the 1873 Comstock Act bans using the mails to ship any drug for producing abortion. Alito, meanwhile, accused the federal government, blue states, and Big Pharma of conspiring to undermine the court's Dobbs decision, which was supposed to return abortion to the states. He noted that because of telehealth mifepristone, abortions had actually increased in Louisiana since 2022. President Trump could help red states enforce their abortion laws by forcing a rewrite of the FDA rules, said Dace POTUS in USA Today. But rather than stand up for a moral priority, which may lose him some pro-abortion voters, he's content to let the pro-life side fail in the courts. Mifepristone could still lose in court, said Michelle Goodwin in The Nation. Alito and Thomas' dissents strategically planted seeds that could bear fruit in future prosecutions or cases against patients, doctors, and even pharma execs. The Comstock Act, which also barred the shipping of pornography and contraceptives, has been defunct for decades. But anti-abortion activists are now almost certainly looking to revive it. The court will be remembered for playing roulette with pregnant patients' lives. The next spin of the wheel could come any day. On the poll watch, 77% of Americans say their income is not keeping up with inflation. 59% say gas prices have created a financial hardship. And we'll finish with a quote from Boris Johnson, who says, "The herd instinct is powerful, and when the herd moves, it moves." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.